On this week's 51%, has dating gotten harder in recent years? We speak with sociologist Sabrina Strings about the changing romantic landscape for women in the U.S. and why she feels we're witnessing the end of love.
I hope that it's not the end of love, but only the end of romantic courtship and romantic ideals. I mean, love is primordial. It's always been there, but we cannot expect to get to that through the romantic pathway.
I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on. I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh Lita. I wasn't really in it. I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Jesse King. Today's episode is for those who feel unlucky in love. I have a lot of friends on dating apps right now, and from what I hear, not many of them are loving it. A 2019 poll by the Pew Research Center found nearly half of U.S. adults and a majority of women feel dating and finding love has become harder in the past 10 years. Now, there have been some polls that are a little bit more optimistic in attitude, if not results, but go online and you will find any number of articles, videos, and social media rants cursing the dating scene and trying to explain why it has gotten so bad. Dating apps create the illusion of infinite options and can feel dehumanizing. The so-called gender wars on social media don't help and stoke anger and distrust on both sides. And our very idea of what an acceptable relationship is changing. We have more options to choose and negotiate on now. More people are choosing non-monogamy, and the term situationship, where people are more than friends but less than committed partners, is widely used in pop culture. Our main guest today has her own reasons to add to the pile. Sabrina Strings is a sociologist, professor, and North Hall Chair of Black Studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Her previous work has focused on the racial origins of fat phobia and the racism found in some yoga communities. Her new book, called The End of Love, applies that lens to heterosexual romance. Through historical research, critical analysis, and yes, some personal experience, Strings argues that what we view as traditional romance between men and women historically only ever really applied to white women, with some happy exceptions. And really, she says it was a very specific type of white woman. Now she argues romance is practically on its deathbed for women across the board, partly due to backlash against decades of social and feminist progress. To be clear, Strings is not saying that men are innately toxic or that they don't want love or commitment themselves. Dating sucks for men, too. But we're a women's show. Strings' book focuses on women, and she argues that sexism and racism have evolved over the years to continue manipulating women in the areas it still can by denying them loving partnerships.
For years, I would just tell people about these awful dates and I would pass them off as a joke. It was like a way of entertaining my friends. And then once I was hanging out with friends and we were in Napa Valley in a jacuzzi, you know, which might undermine the rest of the story because we were being rather fancy for graduate students. But I was just telling a couple of friends about the latest man disaster I'd been through. And one of them turned to me and said, "Are you okay?" And it was the first time that I started to reflect on the reality that for a very long time, I had been acting like these awful, painful experiences were just a joke I could pass off. And I was doing that largely because there is such an intense pressure to be in a romantic partnership in this country. So if it doesn't work out, try again. That one didn't work out, try again. You're never able to get free of it. So I decided to just start journaling about my dating experiences. And the result was a compilation of stories that were painful and hilarious. And I thought, there are a lot of women who are going through this, and maybe I can help them by explaining my experience.
The title of your book is The End of Love, Racism, Sexism, and the Death of Romance. I guess, why do you feel like we're witnessing the end of romance as we traditionally view it?
Well, it's one thing if you are just experiencing a series of bad dates, but it's another thing when you take a look at the data. So what the data show is that the majority of women over the age of 18 are single. It's something like 52%. Now, that's a minor majority, but it's a majority nevertheless. And this is a revolution. Within American history, it has not been the case that the majority of women are single. Now, some of the single women want to find partners and they can't. Some of us don't want to find partners and are finally feeling okay just being. So I decided that instead of just talking about this as an individual phenomenon or even a phenomenon that's just impacting Black women, and there's definitely a racialized component to this, I thought it was important to acknowledge that if most women are not in these romantic partnerships, that's a sign that these romantic partnerships are going away, because there's no evidence whatsoever that these ideals, the idea about how people are supposed to behave when they're courting, is going to be recovered and that people are going to return to that. Instead, it seems like people are walking away from that.
So what do you view as some of the driving factors behind this then?
You know, the funny thing about this is that I often think about Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Right? We've all heard of this idea. The idea is that there's a man who is in the world and he's respectable and he's doing what he's supposed to do. But then on the low, he's doing a bunch of seedy things that people would not expect or admire or even want to find out that men are getting up to. So there's been this Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde component of the relationship between romance and pornography for a very long time. So for a very long time, actually, since at least the 1950s, if not the 40s, a number of men have shown up in society to engage within romantic courtship rituals. But sort of behind the scenes, we're invested in these girly magazines, you know, the films and all of this. The problem is that the proportion has shifted such that a long time ago, more men would have expected to at least try to end up in a marriage. But after the advent of Playboy, in which Hugh Hefner and other writers who were affiliated with the magazine were saying, don't get into committed relationships with these feminist women. And also, if you choose to have a relationship with a woman, make sure she is slender and white and attractive and pliant. Since that messaging, we have found that there are far more men showing up to be Mr. Hyde than Dr. Jekyll.
Your book specifically focuses on how difficult it can be to find love as a woman of color and how traditional romance actually has left women of color out of that story over time. I guess maybe we should start at the beginning of that. You know, if we're witnessing the end of love now, when did love start? When did our idea of traditional romance even come about?
So the idea of romance actually began in the 12th century in France. And it started as a way for people who are affiliated with the nobility to describe their ideal of infidelity. So what we have is the Queen of Aquitaine, who was also the mother of Richard of Lionheart, Queen Eleanor of Aquitaine. She decided to work with a man, Christian de Troyes, to create a story that would ultimately be the Lancelot tale. So the way the Lancelot tale works is that Lancelot is supposedly a knight. Now, significantly, this is a fictional story. There's no evidence that Lancelot ever actually lived. Lancelot is supposedly a knight with a King Arthur's round table. And at a certain point, King Arthur's wife, Guinevere, is kidnapped. And so the knight, Lancelot, volunteers to save her because he's been harboring a secret affection for her. Now, we won't get into the full rundown of the story, but it is the genesis of the ideal of romantic courtship, because the man is supposed to be valorous, courageous, self-sacrificing, and willing to provide. That is what masculinity, as it is attached to the Lancelot ideal, is about. Women were supposed to be pliant and sweet and attractive and docile, but also elite. So what we have here is the very idea that a man is actually supposed to be aiming upward, right? Back in the day, they used to call that finding a woman outside of his league to court. And so this is the genesis of our courtship ideals. Obviously, the 12th century was long before our current conceptions of race. I mean, our idea of race actually began in the 17th century, but was really built up in the 18th and 19th centuries. But to the extent that the women who were supposed to be pursued for these romances were never supposed to be anything other than the nobility, or at minimum, middle class, right? They were never supposed to be peasants or slaves, which, by the way, was also written down by one of the early observers of this new romantic trend, a man by the name of Andreas Kappianos. Because slaves and peasant women were never supposed to be eligible for a romance in the first place, when the enterprise of slavery started to take hold globally, there was never the expectation that white men going to the colonies and meeting Black women who they might have wanted to have sex with would have needed to court them in any way. No, you just, as Andreas Kappianos would have said in the 12th century, you just take slave women by force, right? You just take advantage of them. You rape them, in fact. We obviously know that that is one of the legacies of slavery, but we've rarely connected that to romance. But it was actually part of the romantic ideal. Only elite women need apply. So in the contemporary time in which Jim Crow has been abolished, at least legally, now Black women are supposed to be eligible for these romances, but you rarely find people being excited to pay for things that they used to get for free. So there aren't a whole lot of men who are lining up to engage these courtly behaviors when it pertains to Black women. So these are some of the issues that Black women are experiencing. Since the 19th century, romance has been connected to marriage. And yet for Black women, romance was never supposed to be something that we were eligible for in the first place.
You say in the book that the way that pop culture has described and portrayed Black women is obviously problematic. You know, it creates this messaging that they are somehow too extra or, I guess, less feminine than other women. And you dedicate a chapter about how this has even seeped into Black music and how rap and hip hop frequently talk about and depict Black women in like this hyper-sexualized way. How did we get here exactly in those genres?
So not a lot of people realize that hip hop began as an outgrowth of the civil rights movement. As the civil rights movement was sort of dying down, there was an uptick in gang violence in places like New York. And so one of the things that happened was that some of these groups of individuals who were formerly parts of gangs converted into DJ crews because they wanted to reduce the violence that existed in their community. And they also wanted to sort of continue this kind of revolutionary activity that was about love and uplift, especially for Black and Brown folks. So it was Black and Latino young men who were throwing these DJ parties in lieu of having these gang battles, right? How revolutionary is that? How powerful? And so if you listen to some of the early hip hop, there were battles about DJ skills, but there were also a lot of commentary about poverty, about racism, and about police brutality. Over time, as hip hop started to gain popularity, the message became increasingly about girls. I don't think I have to explain why that would be the case. I mean, if we're talking about things that sell, obviously, we know without even having to be told that sex sells. Mm-hmm. And so the records where men were talking about their sexual desires, their sexual conquests, those really took off. So in the interest of turning a dollar, we find that rap went from being a revolutionary musical vehicle to a form of pop music that celebrated, unfortunately, in many instances, the degradation of women and especially the degradation of Black women. So there's a curious irony here because some people might be old enough to remember the crusade of Tipper Gore, who was like, we need to stop these misogynistic messages, right? And there were so many Black people, including Black women, who said, this is our music, this is our culture. And part of the argument they were making is that, well, this is representative of things that actually exist in our community. But I don't think that the people who were standing by and supporting these kinds of messages understood that they weren't just about a few people here and there. No, they were becoming a representation of Black women and really the Black community writ large. So I think there are a number of people who might regret the fact that they were fighting against ultimately the idea of sexism being allowed to flourish. I think more Black women in particular today would instead ally themselves with people like C. Dolores Tucker and even Tipper Gore, who are saying misogyny in music hurts women.
We're speaking with Sabrina Strings, author of The End of Love, Racism, Sexism, and the Death of Romance. Well, as you said earlier, you know, this whole idea of traditional romance is based off the Lancelot tale. The Lancelot tale wasn't a real event. It's a made-up story. And so obviously the stories that we tell one another have a huge impact on the way we view one another and the way we treat one another in all aspects of our lives. I guess, you know, with that in mind, as you're looking around at the way we tell stories today, are there any messages that you're seeing, good or bad, that are helping to shape the romantic landscape for women?
Actually, one of the things that I find delightful is the sort of black wife effect. I'm not sure if you've seen this on TikTok, but it was a trend. You know, it was really popular a few months ago, where a variety of different men of different backgrounds, but most of them were white, would create these posts to explain their deep love and affection for their wives who were black, or their girlfriends who were black, and all of the things that that relationship has given them, you know, so like confidence, a new style, swag, all of that. So there's definitely a way in which some black women are able to have access to the benefits for many of them of romance. But it's simply not something that happens all the time. The vast majority of the experiences that Black women are having within dating are that they are going out on dates where men are being cheap and rude and are expecting sex and also expecting to ghost the woman later. So this is part of the major issue. A lot of Black women who are seeking romantic relationships are finding themselves in these non-committal situationships that have no possibility for growth or commitment. It's somewhat of a mixed bag. It's not as if there are no stories of women who are Black finding long-term romantic affection. It's just that they are in the minority.
One thing that certainly comes to mind to me as well is the increased discourse around, you know, traditional wives or trad wives. And you make it clear in the book, you know, racism plays a role in the end of love for women, but also sexism, good old misogyny, also plays a role in the end of love for women. So let's talk a little bit more about that other side, I guess.
There is a tremendous backlash to feminism that has been going on since the early decades of the 20th century that has largely functioned under the radar. And part of the reason for that is that men weren't coming out publicly to tell women, I'm against feminism. And this to me is the chicanery of it, the treachery of it. It's like you want to be respected as courageous, bold, brave, proud men, but instead of telling women directly that you're against feminism, you're doing the thing that was on a Key and Peele sketch where you're in the basement whispering to your friend about how, you know, the woman in your life is a bitch. It's like, okay, I'm sorry.
You're okay. You're allowed to say that.
So, I mean, there's the underhandedness of it that is underlying this tremendous shift, because men have for a very long time been angry about feminism. And what they've been angry about is the idea that women would dare step away from these traditional roles that they have loved so much, in which women more or less function as domestic servants in the home. They're responsible for having the children, for raising the children, feeding them, cooking, you know, cleaning up. So, I mean, obviously we are seeing since at least the 1980s, maybe even in the 70s, more men being willing to take up some of these tasks. But that's literally a direct result of the feminist agitation that began in the early 20th century in the United States. Actually, it began in the late 19th century, but really picked up with the question of suffrage. So ever since at least the early 20th century, there have been so many men who have been angered by the idea that women are kind of eroding the boundary between what makes a woman and what makes a man by asking for jobs in the public sphere and by not wanting to cook and clean for a man. And so that is the reason why we're seeing so many men now being wary of women, because if women aren't choosing to be wives for those traditional reasons, then why are they choosing to be wives? No, we want trad wives.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's worth pointing out that in most households, women are still doing the majority of the household labor. Even in like egalitarian couples where both people are making a lot of money, women are still doing the majority of the work at home. And I want to just like briefly bring up a study that I found from a sociologist named Allison Damager. She went out and surveyed couples about why they divide tasks the way that they do at home. And it's interesting that even amongst those egalitarian couples, they would say things like, well, we believe in an equal division of household labor for other couples. But for us, you know, this setup is what works best for us. You know, she's a little bit more type A, whereas I, as the husband, I'm a little bit more laid back. And so this just sort of suits our personalities better. And that's not to say that that's getting at what you're trying to get at here, but it just jogged my mind about the study a little bit. And it just makes me think about, you know, the mental gymnastics that we do to avoid saying what it is we actually want, whereas like maybe sometimes like people just want to divide tasks up this way. And instead of just saying that, we do all of these other things.
Yeah, I love that. And I think that the reason for that is that if men were to be more honest and simply to say, I want a trad wife, it's not as if they couldn't find one. They could find one. There are those women, obviously, who want to be in more traditional relationships. The problem is that it gives them fewer options for the kinds of women they can have sex with. Because if you're on the apps, you might ultimately hope at one day down the road to find a woman you think is suitable trad wife. But maybe today you just want to get laid. So instead of just pursuing a trad wife, they want to be able to have it all. They want to be able to have sex with the women who are sexually liberal, but then they want to be able to settle down with a woman who is conservative.
We touched on it a little bit earlier, and I'm not sure how much we can really get into it here, but how has the increased availability of pornography been impacting the expectations that people have in their relationships?
That pornography is having such a dramatic negative effect on romantic relationships. So as I mentioned before, there's almost like a hydraulic effect. Like pornography has existed for millennia. Romance has existed only for one millennium. And what we are seeing now is that even though porn was always sort of there, like as an undercurrent, now it's really the main story. You could easily, as a young man, start watching pornography at any age. I was talking to one of the women that I work with, and she told me that when she was in college, she met men who had been watching porn since they were 4 years old. And the national average of when young boys start watching pornography is 10. So what does it mean that we allow boys of any age to fill their eyeballs with images of women being treated like holes? And then we expect them, I don't know, 20 years later, when they're of quote unquote marriageable age, to suddenly turn into these romantics who treat women with respect. These two things are incompatible.
And I think that brings it back around to, you know, technology, social media, dating apps, which have drastically changed the dating scene in the US. And I mean, they're not going anywhere anytime soon, I don't think either.
I think the dating app question, something I didn't take up in my book because there's quite so much commentary about it already, but it's worth mentioning that a few weeks, or maybe even I think only 1 week after my book came out, there was another book of the same main title that came out, The End of Love. And this was by an Argentinian woman who's a journalist, and she was taking a look at the dating apps. Now, I'm not going to dig all into her work. I'm not as familiar with it in the first place. But one of the things that I do know about these dating apps is that they give the illusion that you can find your quote unquote perfect match through these extraordinarily superficial mechanisms. Like, so the main thing that you're looking at on a dating app is a person's picture. And when we ask ourselves, okay, well, how do we judge people in the United States? It's based on standards of attractiveness rooted in white dominion. So that you're probably going to look for someone, if you're a man and you're heterosexual looking for a woman, you might look for a woman with fair skin, with straight hair, who is slender. She might appear to have the trappings of wealth. So you're going to be looking for a woman who is more white and more elite. And so how is it possible, using these very superficial mechanisms, that you're supposed to be finding your everlasting love? It's another thing that blows my mind. We don't want to notice all of the ways in which we have very conflicting and competing desires, and not all of them can be met.
Well, all of this put together, I mean, puts together kind of a depressing picture, you know, and it kind of makes me think about how at the beginning of this conversation, you said that more women are choosing to walk away from relationships or remain single. So what's the future here? If we're seeing the end of love, what does the future of relationships look like? Are we going to see more people just decide to, you know, I guess, do their own thing?
You know, I hope that the death of romance is not the end of love, you know, so I wrote the title to be provocative. I hope that it's not the end of love, but only the end of romantic courtship and romantic ideals. I mean, love is primordial. It's always been there. Many different types of love, love of your family members, love of your friends, love of a sexual partner, that can exist. But we cannot expect to get to that through the romantic pathway. That was always about maintaining patriarchy and controlling women's bodies. I don't think a lot of people understand that the genesis of marriage in and of itself is for men to be able to establish paternity, full stop. That's why marriage was invented. And then when romance got attached to it, it wasn't just about establishing paternity, but it was about making sure you find the right type of good-looking, elite, pliant woman. We cannot live in an environment where we're talking about equality amongst the myriad sexes that exist right now and expect to be in a romantic courtship that leads to marriage. It won't work for the majority.
Well, Sabrina, thank you so much for taking the time. Lastly, you know, I just want to ask if you have any advice, I guess, for anyone who might be dating right now, especially if they're a woman of color. Are there any words of wisdom that you'd like to leave them with?
You know, we didn't get to this too much, but dating actually began in the United States in the early 20th century as well. So what an irony, right? So right at the time in which dating is being devised, so too is feminism really taking off in the United States, as well as men's backlash to it. So dating has always been a fraught enterprise because men have always been afraid that they're going to find one of these liberated women who is just going to be taking them for a ride. So I describe in the book the fact that gold diggerism also began in the early 20th century. And it's not nearly as widespread amongst women as people claim, and it is much more widespread amongst men than people want to acknowledge. The point is, I think that dating was a damned institution from jump. You know, it was set up for failure from the beginning. And instead of trying to date and find a romance, what if we were looking to meet people with whom we had similar interests, who we could turn into friends, who we could build a genuine intimate connection with that then could become a sexual partnership, as opposed to trying to find someone we're sexually attracted to and then hope that that will develop into a lasting love? But yeah, people don't know that dating is only about 100 years old and it sucked from the beginning.
Sabrina Strings is a sociologist and professor of Black Studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. She's also a yoga teacher and an award-winning author. Her latest book is called The End of Love: Racism, Sexism, and the Death of Romance. It's out now through Beacon Press. Sabrina, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks to you for listening to 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at our website, wamcpodcast.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can stay in the loop on all of WAMC shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King for 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. The nightmare down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool.